A couple of blundering phrases in a recent Labour Party pamphlet conveyed that impression. But the evidence contradicts it. Even now, Britain is about to join a European payment union, which will ease and expand trade among all the Marshall Plan countries. Labour Britain is marching in step with her non-socialist partners in the Atlantic Pact. She is at one with France, Belgium, Holland, and Luxembourg in the Brussels Treaty, a political and military alliance. The British are faithfully carrying out dozens of trade agreements with anti-socialist governments. Well then, is it isolationism that kept Britain outside the maternity ward while the Schuman Plan was being born? True, the British are unwilling to tie themselves more closely to Europe if that pulls them away from their own Commonwealth or from the United States. But that goes for British conservatives, liberals, and socialists alike. The real expression of isolationism in Europe nowadays is neutrality in the American-Russian struggle. Yet Labour Britain rejects that idea completely and has aligned itself unmistakably on America's side. It isn't socialist isolationism that kept Britain away from the Schuman Plan conference. It was unwillingness to agree in advance to put Britain's key industries under an authoritarian European board. You may ask why, if others were ready to forego that much sovereignty, the British held out. But did all the others accept unconditionally? No. Holland's attending the Schuman Conference with a proviso that if the plan seems impracticable to her, she's free to walk out of it. But the French declined to admit Britain on those same terms. The British were asked to commit themselves unreservedly. Would you expect President Truman to place American steel and coal under a supranational authority from which the U.S. government would take orders? The British are ready to support a plan to bring Europe's steel and coal industries into a working partnership. Before long, they'll disclose their proposals. They'll suggest that responsibility for joint planning of Europe's basic industries shall fall on the government, rather than on a self-perpetuating authority above the government. While Schuman says pooling of production is the pivot of his plan, Attlee will put the accent on increasing steel consumption. That means opening new markets for Europe's steel and coal exports in other continents and with American financial backing. A European authority working on existing demand, says Britain, could operate only on a restricted basis, like a cartel. But if consumption grows, production would rise to meet it. Some able, progressive American economists over here believe the British approach makes good sense.
Thank you, Mr. Kuhl. I notice, Morgenthau, that both Monsieur Bonnet and Mr. Kuhl have given high priority to the economic aspects of this plan. What assessment do you make of its economic possibilities?
There is, of course, no way of telling, Simpson, at this stage, what the economic consequences of the Schuman Plan might be. But so much is sure that the intentions of Mr. Schuman were not primarily economic. It might well be that the double pricing can be abolished, that the competitive position of the combined European coal and steel industries will be better than it is now, that a general rationalization will take place in Europe in these and other fields. But this is by no means the decisive point. The decisive point is political and not economic.
I suppose it might also be said that whatever the potentialities from the economic point of view of such a scheme, that it will not make any immediate or direct contribution to Europe's main problem, which is the problem of closing the dollar gap. Nor will it solve that other difficulty under which Western Europe has suffered since the close of the war, the barrier between East-West trade. So its economic possibilities can easily be exaggerated. And then you have made the further point that whatever these possibilities, this plan is not primarily an economic, but a political plan.
Sure it is. For the French, since the First World War, have labored under one great and, in my opinion, justified obsession, the danger of Germany. They knew as any impartial observer must know, that if you let nature take its course in Europe, Germany, by virtue of its geographical position, the numbers and quality of its population, and its natural resources, will of necessity become the master of Europe. In order to forestall this eventuality, the French, after the First World War, have first tried to get a American-British guarantee of the Rhine frontier. When they didn't get it, they tried to achieve the same objective by other means, by a system of alliances with the countries of Eastern and Southeastern Europe. When this didn't work, they tried to supplement that alliance or that system of alliances with an alliance with the Soviet Union, and so forth. Now they know that in the East-West struggle, if nothing happens, Germany will of necessity become the predominant member of the Western coalition on the continent of Europe. For without the manpower and without the industrial resources of Germany, the West cannot make itself strong enough to withstand Soviet pressure.
Would you think it a fair comment, Mr. Morgenthau, on this French initiative, that they're following an old maxim of business and politics, that if you can't destroy a rival, you ought to make a partner of him?
Of course, if you can't beat them, join them. And this is exactly what the French are trying to do. This is, of course, a very dangerous and risky business. For there is no way of telling which one of the two partners is going to swallow the other, or whether both partners can live peacefully side by side. And Mr. Kuhr has correctly pointed to the fear prevalent among official circles in France that such a union will turn out to be to the benefit of the stronger partner, and that is Germany. It's exactly for this reason that the French have been and must be very anxious for the British to come in order to strengthen the non-German segments of that new combine.
Well, your reference to the British raises the standing disagreement between France and Britain as to the best method of pursuing European unification. There appear to be two methods, don't there? This French plan, which in its boldness approximates to a federal solution of Europe's problems, and the English procedure, which is much more cautious and which insists that cooperation should proceed through the machinery of negotiation by mutual consent and should not involve a tribunal in which a majority, in which Britain might not, for example, be represented, would be in a position to impose its decision on independent nations. Which do you feel is the more fruitful of these two approaches to the problem of unification?
Well, I would say that looking at it from the French point of view, the Schuman proposal is the only one which carries any probability for success. For the British proposal, that is to say, the continuation of international agreements made by sovereign nations is going to be a very slow and very uncertain process. The French proposal will inevitably lead, if it can be successful at all, to the merger of the sovereignties of the individual European nations in a supranational authority whose competence will not be limited to steel and coal, but will of necessity expand into the other economic, political, and military spheres.
Well, what do you suggest should be the British decision? You know, of course, that this whole matter is being debated in the British Parliament next week between the opposition and the government.
Well, I can well understand British hesitation. First of all, Great Britain is only a European nation in a marginal sense. It is also the head of an empire, and is furthermore the predominant member of a Commonwealth of Nations, which has members on all continents of the globe.
This, you would say, rather than any insularity or any socialist prejudice is the prime reason for Britain's caution in this matter.
Yes, if it were otherwise, one couldn't understand why the Conservatives take essentially the same attitude as the Labourites. I think it ought to be mentioned that the disagreement between the British government and the opposition does not concern the substance of the matter, but only the procedure, that is to say, the blundering way in which the Labour Party and the Labour government have handled the Schuman proposal.
And essentially, the problem for Britain is to strike some kind of balance between its extra-European commitments and its European interests.
Yes. I think the ideal solution, which is in Mr. Schuman's mind, is the establishment of a plan, of a really worked-out project by the continental powers, and then Great Britain will come in as an associate member, not perhaps being subject to the whole rigor of this supranational organization, but carrying on the same purposes on parallel lines, while preserving its national sovereignty.
Yes, and from the first, of course, notwithstanding all the superficial party disagreements, the British attitude to this plan has been one of helping rather than hindering it. And one would expect that in the course of the coming weeks, some method of associating herself with such a plan will be devised in Britain. The Schuman plan we've only just touched upon, but insofar as we've reached any agreement, we would, I think, say that this is a heroic attempt to solve the German problem once and for all and to promote a united, confident, and prosperous Europe. No one can say whether it will succeed. Mr. Schuman introduced his plan with a warning: we are not permitted to fail. Whether it succeeds or not, I think we can agree that in this audacious venture, the European nations deserve all possible encouragement and assistance.
Thank you, gentlemen. Taking part in today's University of Chicago Roundtable on the Schuman Plan, what does it mean to Europe and Britain, were His Excellency, the French Ambassador to the United States, Mr. Henri Bonnet, Frederick Koo, foreign correspondent of the Chicago Sun-Times, and Hans J. Morgenthau, political scientist, and Alan Simpson, historian, both of the University of Chicago. You will want to order a copy of today's roundtable pamphlet and to study the special supplementary articles and materials on the Schuman Plan. Individual copies are 10 cents in coin. Send 10 cents with your order to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. A full year subscription to the roundtable pamphlet costs only $3. By sending $3 to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, you will receive the next 52 weekly issues. Why not begin your subscription with last week's booklet on psychoanalysis and ethics? You can combine roundtable listening with a program of home study, which you complete in your own home. By joining the roundtable home study course in world politics, you have the opportunity to study the basic principles and specific problems of international relations. You receive special individualized guidance by a trained instructor. The course is open to all, and you may begin at any time. Every student joining this home study course qualifies to win a complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica, awarded each month to the student most satisfactorily completing the course. Write the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, for the leaflet describing how you may join the Roundtable Home Study Course in World Politics. Today's roundtable originated in Washington and Chicago. Mr. Frederick Koo's speech was recorded earlier from London for presentation at this time. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.